Welcome to the Male Fertility Podcast, a podcast designed to help, support and educate men as they go through their own fertility struggles. Hi, I'm Kieran.
And I'm Sean. And we'll do that by sharing our stories of what we went through, as well as having guests share their knowledge and experience. Right, let's get into today's episode.
Well, here we are, mate. Episode one, the first official episode of the Male Fertility Podcast. We finally made it. It's not the intro. This is the real thing.
Absolutely. Yeah. Number one, numero uno. I think actually if it was a TV series, this one would simply be called Pilot.
I feel like we've done a few though. We mentioned this before, but we are here. We are here and we're happy to be here. So let's just crack straight on, man. So how's your week been?
All right. Yeah. I mean, it's... As you know, we were ill last week, the whole family, all got COVID, which I think, I thought was well out of fashion now, but it turns out it's still around.
Oh, it's still knocking around, mate. It's out there. A lot of people that I've talked to recently have had it. A lot of people I know have had it. I think we had it in the summer, just before we went back to school. So there's been a wave of it. You know, it comes into schools and out of schools.
Yeah.
But I haven't picked it up, and I think it's because I've recently had it.
Yeah.
So it's still trying to get my head around it all, though. Like, what happened over the last 3 years? It's crazy. Absolutely crazy. And I'm sure at some point we'll discuss that in terms of people's fertility journeys.
Yeah.
But you're feeling better. I'm feeling fine. So it's all good right now.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, the introductory episode we did last week, I'm a little bit hoarse. I was having to hold back a lot of coughs on it, but fully fit now, all good. How are you?
I noticed that little on and off button on the mic going. I'm all right. It's been a bit of a mad week for the Hannington household. My son Sebi managed to trip over. He didn't get his hands out in time, and chipped all his front teeth and knocked one tooth up slightly into his gum.
Oh, poor lad.
Smashed all his chin up. So I was waiting for some clients to come into the gym. I got a frantic phone call from Jen saying, can you go to Sebi? He's had a fall. He's had an accident. So I went to him, poor lad, covered in blood, all crying. But he was nails through it. He cried. But he was on a walk. They were going on a night hike, like just around the local race course. And he just tripped. It was just an accident. But he wanted to finish the walk.
Bless him, mate.
We've got to get you to hospital. So we got him there, and then that's all right. And then the dentist the next day, and they fixed his teeth, and then it fell out, and then we had to go back, and it just rolled on, you know. And then on top of that, we had Enya's third birthday at the weekend, which is another experience, you know, three-year-olds running around.
equally as traumatic as falling over and knocking your teeth out, yeah.
For me, no, it was a lovely, lovely time. And then moments that I'll treasure, you know, because there was generally times and I didn't think I'd have those moments. So as stressful as they are, as chaotic as they are, every moment's precious, you know, the good and the bad. You learn from it, you develop as an individual, as a father, whatever way you want to put it. So, yeah, it's been an interesting Hannington household week.
Yeah, sounds a lot more interesting than mine. Us all just staying in.
Yeah, well, in between that, I've fitted in everything else I do.
Yeah, exactly. So it's been in plates, isn't it? But top man. It's like you said, you know, you touched on a few things there about parenting and how it is. It's hard, but people in our boat, having had our experience, we do have that different perspective on it, really, of gratitude and even for the hard moments. And it's not to say that we don't find those moments hard, but you kind of bounce back quicker.
When it is
getting tough, but that's something we'll definitely discuss more at length, I'm sure, in future episodes.
Definitely. I think, you know, it's a topic worth talking about, you know, because of hopefully the guys and girls that are listening to this, you know, their end goal is to be parents. And if you're successful, like, I think it is slightly different if you've been through journeys like ours. Or experiences like ours, You have questions, you have thoughts. And just like as you go through your own fertility journey, you're not the only one that thinks like that and having those thoughts. So we need to discuss it at some point, definitely.
Yeah, absolutely.
But today, we're talking about you, mate. We're talking about you and your journey. And I know you don't like that word. I'm going to say it in brackets, the journey.
Yeah.
But this is something that I've been looking forward to. Obviously, we know each other quite well now, but before we started really developing our friendship, I didn't know everything about your journey, and I still don't. So for me, this is going to be really interesting. I'm looking forward to learning about your experiences in more depth. I will ask those questions that I expect the listeners will be wanting to ask. I'm at the privileged opportunity where I've got this mic and I can ask you them. So it's just crack on, mate, I think. So yeah. How did it all start? Like, start right at the beginning for us.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, and that's the thing, even though, you know, we've had lots of chats, there are, what I find is quite often, and I think this is probably the trauma aspect of the fact that it went over years, and there are bits that sometimes that I forget, and something will remind me of some things, and you think, oh yeah, wow, I've forgotten about that. But I'll try and get it all out today, warts and all. It's our first episode of the pod, so I can't do it a disservice by missing any part. But yeah, so my wife and I, Jenna, we've been married. I can't even do the maths now. We've been married since 2013. 10 years. God, that's 10 years, an easy mate. One, isn't it? Even for me, I could do that on my fingers. So we got together in 2009. We married in 2013. And when we got married, we decided that we lived together, we got married, but we didn't want to, we always wanted kids. We'd already discussed that. We discussed that when we first got together. It was both of our dream. I actually wanted to have 5 kids so right. that I could run my own 5-a-side football team. And she
sounds like a plan.
Exactly. She was a bit like, well, steady on. But we got married and we said to each other, and we're both in agreement, we didn't want to jump straight into that. We wanted to enjoy being husband and wife for a while and enjoy each other. But the interesting thing is that even then, as I said, we got married in 2013, but even then when people were saying, oh, when are you going to have kids then? Because it's literally like, no sooner had I got the ring on her finger, literally, and people were saying that, like, you're even going to do the wedding and stuff. And it's like, that question was already annoying us before we knew we were going to have fertility issues. And because people just assume you're going to follow this narrative that everyone in society takes, or certainly used to back in like kind of the previous generations. But so that annoyed us anyway. And then, so between 2013 and 2017, we did exactly that. We enjoyed being a husband and wife, did a lot of traveling, just at nights out, just really did like build those foundational and strong years of an early part of a marriage, which was...
I think it's so vital, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's that sometimes people think they have to rush into it. And actually, like, you are the most important thing in that relationship, you two. The children, you know, may come. As we've learned, but spending time together is so important in those early days.
Yeah, and ultimately that was, we were building the foundations that we then came to rely on so deeply when we did find out what was going to happen down the line, which was for us then 2017. We decided that time was right. We had moved house the year before. We did that. We were in a small cottage at first, and we moved to a free bed with a double drive, a bigger garden. And we bought an estate car. We were like, right, that's it. Let's have kids. And we were to find out it's not quite that easy. Jenna was on the contraceptive pill, so she stopped taking that. And we had heard or been told that it can take about 3 months to work its way out of the system. So at first, we didn't put ourselves under any undue pressure or stress. We're enjoying trying to make babies, and if it happened, it happened. Those months rolled on, though that 3 month period came and went, and then suddenly it's 4 months, 5 months, 6 months and beyond, and it got to the end of the year and it still wasn't happening.
Mm-hmm.
So we went to the doctors. Now I, you know, I've heard of people being told to go away when you've been come back when you've been trying for this amount of time, that amount of time. I don't know if there is a golden rule of that, but we weren't told that. We've been trying for the best part of a year anyway. And also, I remembered, but I in the back of my mind, I always knew that I'd had mumps when I was 22. Now, the crucial thing with that is that it's post-puberty. So at 22 years old, I started off one morning, I woke up and I had my neck was looking like one of those like bullfrogs or whatever they are, all swollen. And I was like, oh, shit, what's going on? I thought that maybe I had glandular fever. And then I just kept getting more ill. Went to the doctors, had a blood test, and was established quite early on that I had mumps. For three weeks, I was so poorly. And the crucial part of the link between that and my eventual infertility was that the swelling went south to my balls and they swelled up huge, literally like the skin was taut. And but that was 2005. And this was before smartphones, before we all had an absolute wealth of knowledge in our pockets. And I'd been to the doctors, had, you know, huge swelling on my balls, and nothing was said to me about the potential link between mumps, especially mumps or colitis, which is the swelling of the balls, and the link to infertility.
Right.
So because the medical professionals didn't say anything, I just carried on through life. And that's 2005. And actually, my only and main concern at that time was whether I was going to make my lad's trip to Magaluf in a few, I think it was a month down the line. And it was touch and go. Like, I was really ill. I was bedridden for 2 weeks of the three. The fevers were ridiculous. Like, sometimes I'd be like really, really hot, just in my pants. The next minute I'm freezing. I've got loads of clothes on, a hat underneath a duvet. It was really poorly. But, you know, like I said, there was no link drawn to infertility. And in hindsight, you think, well, it's not a stretch to picture the link between my hugely swollen balls and the damage that could be causing and fertility issues. It's not like I went in with a bad knee or a broken elbow or something. I was there literally with like massive balls.
So they didn't say anything?
Not a thing.
No link. It's unbelievable, that, isn't it?
Yeah.
Especially when, if you go on, like, you know, I know you mentioned that the internet wasn't available like it is now, in terms of just a touchy on a phone. But it's all over, like, the internet, about how dangerous it is now.
Yeah.
And they would have known that then. Do you think it would have changed your mindset at the time, or, like, better prepared you to have known that then?
That's difficult to say. I mean, the easy answer would be, oh yeah, of course it would. But I was 22. Like, my only and main concern was getting to Magaluf, and generally my main concern was all the things a 22-year-old lad is interested in. It's like,
birds and girls, mate.
Exactly. Like nights out every Saturday, every Thursday and Saturday, me and my mates were going out. Chatting up girls, etc. I'd like to think so, and especially I think if a medical professional said, "Look, this could be an issue. Bear it in mind." But it wasn't said. I just carried on. I went to Magaluf, made it. I'd lost loads of weight. I couldn't eat for the best part of 2 weeks. So I thought, "Oh, happy days. I'm cut." It didn't need to.
It's always a silver lining, mate.
Yeah, exactly. But then the actual, like, you know, the hilarity is when I look at pictures of 22-year-old me, I was such a skinny little gimp. And but I was like, I'm in great shape, let's go MAGA. But so that's 2005. Fast forward, it's now end of 2017, and in that time, like, you know, knowledge has come on a lot, and a few things have been said over the years of the potential link and that. But again, you just kind of, I was just putting it, I was going, no, I'll be fine, because I'd had a picture taken. So a good mate of mine, Warren, he was a postie at the time, and he'd already had mumps. So every day he would come around or text me, because we had one of those like early Nokia phones, like the little square screens.
Oh yeah, yeah.
He'd be like, "Oh, do you need anything?" I'd be like, "Yeah, bring me fruit polos or whatever," because I used to like those when I was ill. And one day I was like, "I don't need anything. Just come over. I need you to do something." And he was like, "Yeah, how can I help?" And I dropped my pants and was like, "You need to get a picture of this." And he was just like, fucking hell. Like, I had that picture for years. I don't know where it is, but this was in the days where it cost 50p to send a picture.
Oh, yeah.
It kind of went early days viral. Yeah, exactly. But you had to really weigh up whether it was worth sending something because it cost so much money. But then if there was like an error, it would send twice. You're like, oh, fuck. You know,
cost me a quid.
But so that photo, you know, having had that and shown people like work colleagues thinking it was hilarious. And then it was from that. I remember one bloke saying, well, you know, that can make you sterile, mumps. And I still hate that word now. Hate it. And again, I just laughed it off. But anyway, having that in the back of my mind, somewhere in the recesses of my mind, was what then, when I went to the doctors, that's a huge bit of digressing there, but it's all relevant. It's all part of the story. So
it's the big part of the story. It's the potential cause of the whole story, isn't it? It's the catalyst that sent it all going. And the people need to know that there might be someone on here who listening who hasn't put that link together. Mm. You know, they've just missed that information. So it's a very important part.
Yeah, and that's the thing. Like, so having that little inkling in my mind, telling the doctor that, and thankfully he took our concerns seriously, referred us on for tests. So I was sent out of county. We didn't have the facility where I lived to conduct sperm analysis. So I was sent up to Cambridgeshire.
Hmm.
Went up there, had to do a sperm sample. So you get a free one, and you know, again, like, I look back at myself then, and so I was 34. And it was all a little bit bantery, like, oh yeah, just got to go and do this, it'd be fine.
Yeah.
And my only inkling of what it could be like, any perception of giving a sperm sample, was from Road Trip, the film. You've seen that?
Yes, sir.
Yeah. And of course, it's nothing like that. And suddenly, like when I got there and I've walked into this clinic, the kind of reality dawned on me very quickly.
Yeah.
It's very obviously like clinical, very sterile, to use that word again, in a different context. I don't mind using it in that way. And very formal, you know, you're given a form, you look at it and they're like, yeah, you have to note down if you've like missed any, if you missed the cup, and write down when, what time you produced the sample and all this. And then I get taken to this room, and it's just the most ridiculous room. Like, there was a chaise lounge there, a telly and the remote was in a freezer bag.
Yeah.
And then some magazines, all stuck together pages.
I'm laughing because you're describing it exactly. I think they're up and down the country like this. They're just the same look.
Exactly.
Wherever you go. And we'll talk about experiences in more detail at some point.
Yeah, this is going to be an episode in itself for sure.
For sure.
Yeah, I mean, I joke about the magazine. I didn't actually touch them. And that's the other thing. So I thought, there's no way my ass is going near that chaise lounge. There's no way I'm touching that remote that's in a freezer bag. And there's no way I'm using those magazines from the 1980s.
I'll give you a little bit of something that happened to me, right? I know we're in the middle of you. But once I used the magazine and I took it, right? And we were driving home and I said to Jen, have a look in that bag. I've got something for you.
Brilliant.
And she wasn't happy.
Amazing.
But that's one story. There's lots to do. But
poor bloke after you has walked in and gone, fuck, what do I use?
There was loads of them.
it's ridiculous, isn't it? And so thankfully I had 4G, so I just used a good old internet. And yeah, it was weird, mate. And I did it, and there was a little service hatch in the room, and I had to put it in along with the paperwork and ring a bell to say I've done it. And it's weird because I heard someone open the door like straight away after.
Like, oh, they're waiting.
Yeah. And now, God, he's taking ages. But then I went to leave and realized that I left the door unlocked because I was so panicked. But so I did that. I got through that and waited, I think, 2 weeks or so. And I was at work one day and I get a phone call and I knew it was the doctor's. It was my GP. So obviously I got the number saved. No, it's them. So I ran outside to take it. And I'll never forget this moment because so the girl who's phoned me, I'm pretty sure I don't know who it was, but I'm pretty sure to this day it was probably the receptionist. Because essentially what she was being asked to do was phone me and ask me to book a second appointment. But so I'm like, okay. She's like, yeah. She started reading the letter essentially that she's got in front of her. And I can only imagine that she didn't proofread that letter first, because she's going, yeah, you need to come. We need to get you to do a second sample. And it says that you've got, and then she stumbled over this word. She clearly hadn't proofread it. She was trying, she said, it says you've got azoospermia. And I was like, well, what does that mean? And she said, I don't know. And I was like, okay.
Yeah.
So kind of there and then booked the second test in 3 months time. And she explained it has to be 3 months. And I know now that because the sperm cycle is 90 days for sperm to regenerate.
Yeah.
That's what they're trying to do, see if any given result is an anomaly, and to see if anything changes in 3 months. Obviously, I don't know that at the time. Get off the phone and Google this azoospermia word to find out that it means I've got zero sperm, like none.
Yeah.
And I was like sitting there on this concrete slab outside my office. Zero. People have tens of millions. How can I have none? And it was literally a life-changing moment. And then having to phone my wife and pass on the news, obviously on the phone, there's no way I could have sat on that and waited till I got home.
No. A lot of guys will be listening to this that experienced exactly the same thing. I know you, obviously, how did you feel like immediately after it? Was it kind of a bit of an out of world experience, or was it a case of I just don't have a fucking clue what this means?
Yeah, I'd say absolutely that moment it was like being in shock. So I remember my wife saying, well, like, you know, come home. Like, I don't think she was at home, but she's like, let's go home. Like, she was at work as well, and I was like, no, it's fine, I'll see you home later. And I went back into the office and just carried on as if everything was normal, and like chucking about banter, and it was ridiculous. And all I can say that is shock when you go into that and you're not really taking anything in, and the severity of what I've just been told hasn't really kicked in at that moment. And that came in the kind of certainly that evening and moving onwards. And how I describe that, it's like suddenly I've been chucked into this river, like a fast flowing river. And that river is fertility treatment and that the fertility world. And suddenly I'm just in it. I can't get out. There's no banks. I'm just flowing along fast. And it's such a rough ride that sometimes I'm getting pulled under and I'm like, I can't breathe. Other times I might pop up and you hit a bit of a slow spell on the water. Yeah. And suddenly you're not really moving forward. You're just kind of there, stuck.
Floating.
In the doldrums. Like, that's what fertility journey is like. It's either rapid or slow. You can be waiting months for appointments and results and referrals. And that's essentially, so I went and did the second test in March 2018. And the result was the same, none. So then the whole rest of that year, the whole of 2018 essentially that first phone call to January the 2nd, was in March, which confirmed it. That whole year was then just being pushed from pillar to post. Tests here, go to this hospital, speak to this urologist. And then I'm like, what's a urologist? Oh, then you go and speak to this andrologist. I'm like, well, what's the difference between that and a urologist? You have to take on all these new terms, all these new scientific and medical words you've never heard before. You don't want to hear. You don't want to be part of it.
You're forced to.
You're in it.
That complete, within one phone call, you've lost complete control.
Mm.
Like, it's incredibly hard, man. And there'd be, like I said previously, there'd be guys on here that are there now. So you're being pushed pillar to post, and you don't know how you're feeling, where you're going. What happened next, mate?
That's why I'm trying so hard not to fast forward, but almost nothing happened in 2018. It was just a really hard year in terms of, so we've got this upset. We know that, and you mentioned the word like control. Suddenly we've got this complete lack of control. Things aren't in our hands to create the family we wanted. And then it's trying to get NHS funding. It's a ridiculous situation in this country where the postcode lottery is real.
It's a real thing. It's out there.
Yeah. I mean, I'll come on to it in a bit, but a really shit situation with it. Ultimately with another couple actually. But so in our area, we lived in Hertfordshire at the time, and they didn't have any clinics or hospitals that did fertility treatment. So they essentially outsource it, and they, should you be eligible to get the NHS funding, then where we lived, you then get a package essentially to be funded for two cycles. We could take that funding and go to whatever clinic we chose.
Right. Okay.
Obviously that would, certain clinics have certain prices, so that package will get you so much in some places, and others you might get a bit more or whatever. But that funding didn't come through and get approved until November of 2018. And I was away for work. And I remember, this isn't when we got the funding, but I remember my wife being just at such a low ebb, because the woman who ultimately signed everything off, so you have all sorts of hoops to jump through to get funding on the NHS. It's about your age, whether you've got previous children, your BMI.
The checklist is long.
It's a joke.
Yeah.
And it's stressful. And then the woman who ultimately had the sign off only worked Fridays. And I remember I was away on this Friday. My wife phoned me and she just lost her shit, because this woman, she had, I think, said the previous week, yeah, I'll definitely get it done next week. And then she phoned the office and she was like, oh, yeah, they've gone. And I think they might have looked up the file or something, said, yeah, it hasn't been done. So my wife, I was in Hampshire at the time, and I just couldn't get home. And she was really so upset.
Because,
you know, time's ticking on. We've almost done a whole year now just trying to get this funding and trying to get things cracking.
Yeah.
And fortunately, it was pretty shortly after that it did go through. And I think part of that was that my wife went absolutely apeshit at that point. You know, there's ways of going about things. Look, we know that ultimately shouting and screaming is not going to get you everything you need, but sometimes you need to.
Sometimes you're like, if you don't get heard, you don't get seen, you know. So at this point, mate, you would have been from, if you say in brackets, trying for a baby to this point, it's like nearly 2 years. Is that right?
Yeah, basically, yeah.
It's a long time, isn't it? When you just anticipate it's going to happen, and society kind of tells you it's just going to happen.
Yeah.
I know exactly how you feel, because we've been through a similar thing, but you can understand Jenna's upset. That need for a baby's there, isn't it?
Yeah.
And yours as well.
Yeah.
It's a long time, 2 years, a real long time.
Well, that's the thing. Like the whole of 2017 was kind of like, it was like the initial excitement. Okay, let's do it. Let's get that baby. Like I said, we had all the other pieces in place, like the home and everything. And then as the months went on, it started getting a bit more tiresome, because it's like trying to just then produce on demand. And I remember really well, and Jenna denies it, but I was at work walking along the street with a colleague, and she phones me and she's like, where are you? I'm like, well, I'm at work. Because at this point she was doing those ovulation tests.
Yeah, the ovulation tests. Yeah.
And she goes, can you come home? I'm like, oh, no, I'm at work. Like, you're okay? What's up? Type thing. She was like, oh, it's just, it's a really good time. And I was like, well, we'll be home in a couple of hours. She's like, just get home as quick as you can. and I hung up the phone, and I think my colleague, he's a mate now, and like, He had three kids, and he knew, he just knew what that phone call was about.
He could tell.
He'd been there.
The tone of the mumbling he could hear coming through the phone.
Yeah, and he just went, trying. And I went, yeah. He goes, yes, it gets stressful when it's like that. And I was like, yeah. So, you know, that And then you get, as I said, 2018, the whole year where we're not seemingly making any progress. And then we get the funding and 2019, things really start picking up pace. So we chose our clinic up in, we chose Bourne Hall up in Cambridgeshire, because we were in the middle of there or London, but we were looking at some of the London ones, some of the Harley Street ones, but then we would have to get the train in most of the time to the appointments, and you're taking, you know, with public transport, and it's something you don't want to be missing appointments, or then if I had to have operations, I didn't want to be getting the train home. And as it happens, I did have an operation booked in with through the NHS at a London hospital, the UCLH. But then we chose our clinic up in Cambridgeshire, went to the initial appointments, and the urologist there said, I'll carry on with that. Because so that then comes on to a potential second cause of my infertility. So as I was saying, kind of getting all those initial referrals going to this different person, that different person, and the amount of different doctors that had their hands on my balls that I lost count of.
And you get used to it after a while, don't you?
You just kind of like, drop your trousers. Okay, there you go. And it was it was established actually quite early on that I had also had a varicocele.
Yeah.
Now a varicocele it's like a varicose vein, but it's above the balls, like in the sac, above where the balls sit. Now the reason our balls sit below the body and they hang loose is because sperm needs a cooler environment to really thrive. It needs to be about 2 degrees cooler than body temperature. Now, what a varicocele does, because they're really bulbous, big veins, they then overheat the balls and make them hotter than what they should be. And they can completely stop the manufacture of sperm, or it can just hugely degrade sperm quality. And in my case, it was hoped that if I have the operation to treat that, which is called a varicocele embolization, that I may go from producing no sperm to some. I was told that, you know, it's very unlikely that you're then going to conceive naturally, but what they hoped was that if I would then start producing some naturally, that I could just give a sample, which is the relatively easy option when it comes to fertility treatment, and certainly as to what I came on and ended up having to do, which I'll come on to. But then that could be used for fertility treatment. So I had that operation in March 2019, and I'm fortunate enough that I'd never been in hospital before then. I'd never had any operations, and that was my first experience, and it wasn't
They're
great.
They're unusual experiences, aren't they? Like, I've had one.
Were you awake?
Yeah, I was awake for mine.
Yeah, me too.
And it is a bizarre experience, because it's not necessarily painful. It's not painful at all. It's just... unusual. I found it very unusual.
I think unusual hits the fucking nail on the head. So the University College Hospital in London is a university hospital. They have, you know, the next generation of doctors are training there. And I was asked if I was willing to let a student doctor do the operation. And I said yes. They said it's a final year student. So, you know, very experienced. He'll have an experienced person next to him. And I was like, I'm all for it. The NHS is a wonderful thing. We're very lucky to have it. And I thought, I need to be supporting the next generation. If he's not doing it, how's he going to know how to do it on his own one day? He's got to do it. Someone's got to be the one. So I was like, yeah, of course he can. And, so I'm conscious. They've put, essentially cut out. So they go in through most of the time. And I think in America, more often than not, considering the veins are down near your balls, I think in America, they'll go in through your pelvis. But I think more commonly in the UK, this is just from what I've heard, they're going through the neck, which they did to me.
They went in through the groin for me.
So the way that's been explained to me is going in through the groin is like going through the country roads to get where they need, but going in through the neck is like
just
taking
go
the
straight
M4,
down,
it's more direct. And so what they did, I was under this big shroud, and, They put it this big blanket over me, just apart from a square where my neck is, and I had to lean to the left because it was going on the right hand side, and at first they put like a catheter down through me and then injected dye, and I could feel that dye. It was like cold. Obviously, they'd locally, they'd done a local anaesthetic by this point, but I could feel the dye through my body. So then what they do, they put a catheter through, and essentially then they're passing a wire through my body. And it's weird, as I say this, I swear I can feel the wire. It's like giving me that kind of weird kind of feeling to say I'm here. But they do this all via x-ray, essentially. They watch a screen watching this metal wire go through my body, and that's why they eject the dye so they can see it. And the reason, or certainly in this case, in my case, we're going down through the neck. Main reason why they want to keep me awake is that at certain times I had to breathe in so that they could easier bypass certain areas of the body or whatever, just
open the valves and things. It helps. It's movements.
Yeah. And so it got to a few times they said, right, we need you to breathe in and keep biggest breath you can take, and then hold your breath, and then come, like, you know, 30 seconds or so later they say, okay, breathe out. I'm like, right, good. Then it started kind of going a little bit downhill, and you'd hear things that you don't want to hear when you have an operation. I heard the experienced bloke go, whoa, stop, you know, you didn't want to do that, that would have been game over. I'm lying there thinking, what?
Yeah,
fuck, like, game over, what?
Lights out, mate, done.
Yeah, exactly. And there was another thing, do you know, I don't often want to berate, I volunteer, but there was another thing about it. I haven't recalled the story that much, so it's hard to remember, but there's another thing. I think it was something like, oh yeah, not quite sure what you've done there, or something like that. And so it's not going great at this point for me.
Not the best experience.
And what they'd done, they'd left like the kind of the left side of the shroud open. And every now and again, this nurse, really nice nurse, would come and just look in and say, you okay? I'm like, yeah, because I had to stay with my head to the left. And that was aching as well, like kind of really far over, because they're obviously plugging away and pulling. Oh no, I've just remembered what it was. I could feel my neck, like where they were pulling around and going in. And I said to them, this is probably 5 minutes into the op. And I was like, oh, just one thing. And they're like, yeah. I was like, yeah, I can feel that. Should I be feeling that? And they're like, no. So they gave me a little bit more of a dose of the anesthetic. That's what it was. And I've done the breath holding thing a couple of times. And then they've done it again. They said, nice big breath, please. And I'm there. And, you know, I've got people with implements inside my body. I'm going to do exactly what they tell me to do and when. And I'm there. And I'm like, any danger of telling me to breathe out? Any danger? And they're not telling me. And suddenly I'm like, holding my breath, like kind of starting to convulse a little bit, because I'm desperately trying not to breathe out. Because I'm like, if I breathe out, am I going to put myself at serious risk? And then the nurse obviously saw that I was squirming, and came over and just peered in and were like, are you okay? And I said, can I breathe out? And she was like, and then I heard the doctors go, oh, I'm so sorry. Yeah, sorry, you can breathe out.
She's holding your breath for 30 seconds, a minute.
Oh my God, it was more than that, mate. I think it was about a minute and a half by that point. You know, but I've always been quite good at holding my breath, but you know, that takes
But when the adrenaline's going and the heart rate is pumping, you know, it's,
it
becomes even harder.
So, That was that. I had that operation, and then another 3 months of waiting ensued, because, like I was saying, like, you know, they were hoping that I could then produce some naturally, and again, that 3 month sperm cycle wait comes. So that was from March to June, and then I go to do the sample, and the same again. It was negative, and that sample, we went up to do at the what was now our fertility clinic, and they had a embryology department on site, so they could, rather than waiting 2 weeks for a result, you could get it immediately. And so we left there, driving back to Hertfordshire, and my wife's going to drop me off at a train station to so I could go into London to go to work, and got the phone call. We just pulled up in the train station car park, got the phone call, and to say the results hadn't changed. It was still zero. And we were absolutely crushed. at that point that we had put a lot of hope into that operation because it was a relatively minor one. And it was like, oh yeah, you know, I'd only actually been given 30% chance that it might work. And we'd only been given about 30% chance that it would work. But 30%, that's a good chunk, you know.
Right, you really held on to it.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, really had grasped like really tightly onto that. And I'm an optimist anyway. I always have been a positive person. And I was convinced it was going to work. And then to get that phone call that day, to say that there was still no sperm, that really crushed us. And I remember we were at that train station car park, and it's just life could be cruel sometimes. We just received that phone call, and then a girl walked past the car with a pram and a baby. And I remember Jenna just being so upset, and I was like, you know, where do we go from here? What do we do? And we were essentially back in that state of shock. And I remember her actually saying, because I was like, well, that's it, I'm phoning work, I'm not going in. She was like, no, go in. She's like, I need time, I need to be alone. And so that was, you know, really tough leaving her. But you know, you have to respect when you're going through something like this, you're going to need times where of course you rely on each other and need each other to prop each other up, but there are other times where you do need that time alone or time with friends or whatever. And so that's what she'd asked for. And I went into work. And again, like I said earlier, I went in essentially trying to act like everything's normal. And I've just had the most crushing news. And so then kind of that's June. And the urologist up at the fertility clinic has said if that didn't work, which we now didn't, I have this option of something called a micro-TZ. This was the nuclear option, so to speak. This was having my balls cut open and to look for sperm directly from source, exactly where it's being made, in the hope that they can recover some and to see if there's potentially an issue where it's being blocked from coming out, or by the time it comes out, they're not viable or whatever. So to try and get them straight into the lab, to be able to use again for IVF or most likely ICSI at this point, selecting, you know, one particular sperm and putting it in the egg. And I didn't know if I was going to go for it actually. That we were offered one in, they kind of penciled us in for August 22. Sorry, 22? No, of course not. That's last year. August 19, which was 2 months after that. Well, no, two months after that last result. But some 5 months after the varicocele operation. But because of my experience of that varicocele op and how horrible it was, essentially, I was reluctant to do it. I'd been given this sheet of information of the side effects. And obviously, with any major operation, there's the kind of generic side effects like massive blood loss, blah, blah, blah. But one of the concerning ones was that it can essentially decimate your testosterone levels and prevent my body, my balls from creating it anymore. And that was quite concerning because my levels, the highest I'd ever known them to be, was still on the lower end of normal for someone of my age. And that was established when I first started having like the initial tests and stuff. And I started to kind of think about alternate routes to parenthood. So my wife and I, we had always agreed no matter what it took, we were going to be parents. We kind of had this motto of we haven't come this far to only get this far. That was carrying us through a lot. And you know, we talked about whether we could use donor sperm or adoption, for example. I'd ruled out fostering because my mum still is a foster carer, and as of now has been for about 27 years or something. So I'd had a first-hand experience of that kind of kids coming and going and being adopted or moving on. And that wasn't for me. I wanted a degree of permanence. So the options for us were kind of adoption or donor sperm. And I was coming to terms with it because we're now talking summer 2019. So now 2.5 years since we first started trying, 1.5 years since diagnosis. And not only was 2018 really hard because we weren't seemingly making progress, but it was really hard for me because I was essentially going through grief, and I didn't know that at the time. But I was going through these feelings of, so grief in no particular order, the first four stages are denial, blame, anger, depression. And I don't think it matters. There might be a defined way that the experts have written it, but I can tell you from firsthand experience that they come and go in waves. And I remember them acutely. I remember the blame one, for example, because I phoned my mum and like almost accused her of saying, well, like, why didn't I have the MMR jab when I was a kid? And she was like, you did. So, because, you know, I was looking for a reason why I had the mumps, but like to try and blame her. And, you know, as cruel as that is, but of course, I'm not of rational mind at this time, because, you know, with grief, people associate that with, like losing someone, but I was losing something. It was the death of my ability to pass on my genetics. And so I was grieving that. I didn't know this at the time.
I was going to say, we've talked about this, haven't we, off camera, in terms of you really go through this self-finding journey. Like you almost lose your identity of who you think you are. And you grieve for that. You grieve for that, and it's not until you process those stages that you've just kind of discussed or highlighted that you you start to really become aware of it. And I think I've talked to guys, you've talked to guys that are going through that, are still going through that, have been through it, and everyone's length of time in each of those, or whether they're combined, is all different. It's such a scramble. It's incredible.
Yeah, there is no, you can't force your way through it. That's what I learned. You have to let things play out.
I just wanted to kind of highlight that what you've just said really resonates with me as well. And I'll talk about that in the next episode. But it's important that guys that are listening to this out there realize that that is a completely normal process to go through. And it's vital to be able to process it. Otherwise, you won't get to where you need to be to process it.
So, I mean, having gone through that grief, ultimately the last part of grief is acceptance. And this is the kind of more active phase that you have to reach. The first four phases, I was very much being dragged through it, sometimes unconsciously, not knowing why. I was just angry all the time. But with acceptance, I had to really start pushing myself there. And what I realized is this is, you know, an overarching kind of viewpoint of my whole story. We are going to go in more depth about everything that we're talking about, because there's so many similarities between us, and talk about our perceptions. But ultimately, what really started to build the bridges for me and get me to the point where I was considering alternate routes to parenthood was the acceptance of who I was. And actually how much more I had to give as a man, as a husband, and as a father.
Yeah, I sorry, mate, just jump in there, because it's just echoes exactly what I went through, but from a different experience, if you know what I mean, like a different angle. It's a self-discovery journey, isn't it, as well? Mm-hmm. Not just one about this physical journey that you're going on with your treatment. You learn so much about yourself, and that acceptance, I think, is probably the hardest part of it all.
Yeah.
And, you know, I've talked to guys, you've talked to guys, like everyone comes across that at a different state at different times. But so much similarity. And we're going through so much more detail, but obviously today is just kind of like a brief description of your story. But already there'll be people listening to this echoing. That's me, that's where I am.
That's the thing. It's these are essentially our introductory episodes, so people get to know us, what we've been through, and where we are. But there are, like, everything I'm talking about needs to be almost deconstructed. And it'll be the same for your story, because there are so many parts and it's so complex. Like, I'm talking about grief, like, I'm just summed it up there in maybe 8 or 9 minutes or so. It was like 18 months, 2 years.
it's just like you said, you've summed it up, but to actually go into detail is a completely different, different podcast.
Yeah, exactly. Stay tuned, right? But yeah, I mean, so I was having reservations about doing the micro TZ. I was kind of starting to really get the feeling that I could use donor sperm. That was what we came to actually decide was probably the best option for us and what we both liked to be a part of. Because I really wanted to see my wife, you know, but carry a child and be part of the journey and be there for the NCT and all that. It's hard to think back to everything then, but just every step of the way at the scans, it's all very, that's what I was, you know, feeling really, really robbed of as well. And I wanted to be part of that. And so, you know, in the end, what it came down to is we had a conversation and Jenna actually said, what would you regret less? It's kind of like whether I would just move on, not do it. Would I always have that niggling feeling of should I have done it? Or would you do it and live with the consequences, whatever they are, or they might be fine. And then as it happens, there are consequences, which now, again, this is going to be a whole episode in itself, but I'm now on testosterone replacement.
Right. And that's from that?
Yeah. That basically accelerated my need for it. I expect that I probably would have ended up on it anyway, because when I was 34, having those initial tests, my levels were probably what a 60 or 70 year old man should have.
Right.
I mean, and after the operation, it stopped working. I had the levels of like an 80 to 90 year old man. Mm. I essentially stopped producing it. And she was right. You know, it was a great point. And now being on the other side, being in that situation where I have had it and I'm now living with the consequences of it, I don't regret it. And it's impossible to put myself in the other shoes of having not done it and perhaps not being on TRT yet. But then it's impossible to say whether I would have that niggling feeling.
Yeah.
But all I can say is that from my current viewpoint of where I am happy with my choice. And that's to now come on to that. So I had that operation. Again, I'll explore it more in more depth and hopefully we can even get some experts on to talk about what that involves from their point of view, because I was certainly unconscious. But I had that and there was no sperm found. And unlike all of the other kind of processes and the other operation I'd had, there was no waiting to find that out.
Right.
Literally, I woke up, I came around, and if anyone's seen it, there's a picture on my Instagram. Yeah, literally, where I've got my thumbs up with this kind of massive padded jock strap on and these hospital socks, and I'm sitting there gurning with a big grin.
There must be a thumbs up. There must be a way we can put that as like the image for this podcast.
Maybe one week only. Yeah. I mean, it's on my Insta and it's on my website as well, so it is what it is. But, you know, I still to this day have no idea why I'm flipping smiling. I've just been told there is no sperm. The urologist stood there, he's going, you know, he's just been in both of my nuts.
Yeah.
And it's funny because, like, to me, you know, I got wheeled in the theatre. This is the next thing I know. Mm. Whereas just before we were going down, they were telling both of us that it could last anywhere between half an hour or 2 hours.
Right.
Depending on how much exploration they need to do.
Yeah.
And unbeknownst to me, I was in there for the full 2 hours. And then you kind of, you know, a little bit longer with the patching up and wheeling out and stuff. So my wife knew, and she said she actually found that a really upsetting moment because she was there on her own in this kind of waiting room.
Mm.
The minutes were ticking on, and she was just like, every minute that went past, she knew what the result was going to end up being. So, you know, that hit me. And as much as I thought I was in a place of acceptance before that, it's interesting because actually hearing that result, there's such a stark closure to it.
Yeah.
That actually did, it took some time to get over. It wasn't like, I was like, okay, press the button on donor sperm now, let's go. Firstly, I was in a lot of pain. I've heard of some chaps going back to work after 5 days. Yeah. For the five days after mine, all I could do was be in bed or on the sofa. And if I needed to, which I was trying to avoid, was go to the toilet.
Yeah.
I was walking like John Wayne, and that would be probably doing a disservice to John Wayne. It's like a lot slower to him than him. But yeah, it wasn't a nice place to be. It was achingly, bakingly hot as well. It was the August bank holiday weekend, and oh, it was so hot. And I was just so uncomfortable. I was sitting with ice as much as I could on my balls. Like, I bought these gel packs, like the refreezable, like sports ones, because that was helping with the swelling. But I was in, not being able to do anything for 5 days. And you can't sit on your phone for five days solid. You can't watch telly. I mean, I've certainly given it a good go. But so, yeah, I ended up sitting there alone in my thoughts a lot. And I couldn't expect Jenna to be there all the time. I mean, it was, you know, sunny August bank holiday. I was like, no, you go out. So, but do you know that I often think back to that time, because we live in such a fast-paced world. Everything's go, go, go all the time. How often do we get 5 days to just sit and be in our own heads?
Yeah, it's rare, isn't it?
Yeah.
Like, super rare. But I think it's so important. Like, whoa, we've said it 1,000 times, but we discussed this topic about actually taking your time in terms of taking time for you as an individual and as a couple during a very challenging experience. It's the only way to put it, isn't it? But I didn't have the same procedure as you. I didn't have one of those, but I had an operation on my ankle like years ago, and it was a similar thing. Just sat there doing nothing, and your brain's going, well, this is fine, my head's fine, I need to do something. And it's just another challenge of the situation you find yourself in, isn't it? One that you probably weren't expecting. Like, you didn't expect to feel completely bored for a week or in complete agony for a week. You know, I've talked to people about the microtesia, and it, you know, it's a very intrusive procedure. And there's no way of kind of buttercoating that, is there? You know, you can't. You're gonna be in pain. You're gonna need that time. But when almost there's so much going on in your head, the last thing you want to do is sit still. You know, we talked about the fact before of how important like exercise is to both of us. But you get probably, you know, next to finding out that you have no sperm, the second most emotional news you've received, and you're told, well, now you've got to sit still for 5 days. Yeah. Well, I couldn't imagine how tough it was psychologically.
Yeah. And it was. And like you touched on, we do talk about like how important exercise is for us. And my natural reaction to that would have been either to do some horrendous HIIT workout or go for a walk, because it, for me, that's like meditation. I often am only thinking about what I'm doing right there, and it just is a great escape. But couldn't do that. And I was in my own head, and actually, there's a balance with being in your own head, because I often say to guys now, it's good to work through your thoughts and emotions, feelings, but actually don't stay there too long, because actually you don't start to find answers. You just kind of go around in circles. But that 5 days was almost like the perfect amount of time for me to process a lot of stuff.
Yeah.
And then I started becoming a little bit more mobile, just kind of going for waddles around the kind of the neighborhood, or drive into the town and just walk around. And so, yeah, it was a good moment for me, really. And then, you know, in a bad situation, made the best of that in terms of like self-reflection. And then It took me 4 weeks to get over that op. The last week of which was our first week of holiday in the south of France, first week of two. And I still had the scab on my ball sack at that point. And probably above exercise for me, my number one favorite thing is swimming. And swimming in the sea is like the pinnacle of that. I love it. I grew up in a coastal town. It's like, it's me. And I couldn't do it. I couldn't get in because I still had flipping essentially a wound, and I lasted a few days, and I did, and it got like soft and just fell off. In fairness, luckily it didn't bleed underneath, and to be like the salt water probably good for it.
Would have sorted out, mate.
Yeah, exactly. Does it heals everything. Chop a leg off. Oh, sorry, jump in the sea.
Jump in the sea, it'd be fine.
Yeah.
But there's still that fear with it, isn't it?
Yeah,
like, especially with your previous experience of mumps and stuff, the last thing you want is an infection in your balls. Because you know how painful that is, and it's not a nice experience.
No, it was. It was. quite a moment getting in. I was like, yeah, I was really, really fearful, and yeah, it all worked out for the best, thankfully. And because I was like, come on, it's 4 weeks now, I need to move on. And now,
yeah, the mind wants it. Sometimes the body can't give it, can it?
Yeah.
And I just find that, or I found differently, that even the most basic decision, when you're going through, you know, that experience, that journey, as you know, we don't like to call it, even the most basic decision, you question, you know, like, is this the right decision? Is this going to benefit me or damage what I'm ultimately want to do? And because you might not realize it, but I suspect there was a thought in your head that what if, you know, you did this and it did even more damage, or, you know,
yeah,
very, very highly driven anxiety at that point, I would have expected, mate.
Yeah, yeah. There was still a lot going on in my head. I was still kind of having to re-find that last level of acceptance. Of like, can I, you know, be the father to donor-conceived children? And actually, I read a book on the beach on that holiday, which essentially changed my life. It really pushed me into not just acceptance, but like this like high form of it. And that was, I've got it here somewhere. I don't know where it is. It's called The Little Big Things by Henry Fraser.
Right.
And he's a chap who had it all kind of going for him. Very good rugby player, good at school, and then got paralyzed on a lad's holiday from the neck down. And his story is inspirational. And I think actually, again, I'll save that. Perhaps we should have a episode on, well, yeah, we will, to be fair. There's a lot of stuff that helped me through, and that book was one of them, but a lot of podcasts, a lot of other stories of people who have been faced adversity and been through it and come out the other end.
Yeah.
And 100% I wanted to talk more about those because they were such a big help for me. But that book was huge. That then kind of, as we got home and moved into the autumn, like October, that's when I really started coming back to that place. And I was like, okay, let's start looking at some donors. And we started making our selections, and that we chose kind of middle of both of us rather than just trying to replicate me, because that was something which I had let go of. And I think it is important that I wasn't going to pass on my genetics. I wasn't passing on my looks, my traits. The traits you do pass on, to be fair, but you know, my physical appearance, I had come to terms with the fact that I didn't want to just try and create
a mini new me.
Yeah, because that's all part of that grieving process, really. And I was comfortable that I was letting that go. So we chose middle of both of us, what we both had, like blue eyes, green eyes, the hair color, height, median, and stuff like that. And we were given six donors. Because you also
possible donors,
because we also chose our sperm bank in-house, our clinic, rather than kind of complicate things more by looking to go abroad and ship them in or something, or any other banks in the UK. So it meant that there was less choice, but actually that wasn't a bad thing for us, because it can lead to decision fatigue if you've got hundreds or thousands of selections to make.
Well, it's a massive decision, isn't it? Like, I couldn't contemplate making a decision like that, not even with my experience right now. The processing you've had to go through to do that, as like you said, like let go of that need for that biological connection, but acknowledging that connection is still going to be there.
Yeah.
And then choosing, you know, ultimately what sperm you're going to use for your children. I mean, now, like talking about it, we've talked about it before, it's something that is so complex. And I almost can't imagine or put into words how I'd feel about it. Do you know how I'd have to process that myself? But it's so important that people hear what you know, how you've done it and how you've kind of done that processing and come to the point where you're comfortable with that, because you actually acknowledge that being a father is so much bigger than just that little sperm. Yeah, just it's just interesting. Like I said, talking to you and learning how you've processed that is phenomenal.
Yeah. Yeah, and there's a lot more to explore because, to use your word, it's complex, and it's knowing that that decision that we're about to make is going to impact the rest of our lives and an actual life that we hope to bring into the world.
Yeah, it's so complex that for once I don't really have words to kind of explain how I'm how I'd feel about it. Like that's generally how I'm feeling right now, thinking about it.
There is so much to it, and again, we've got many future episodes to explore that in detail. And we made the selection. We pored over it for a couple of weeks. We made our selection and then we said, right, we're ready to go. And then the kind of spotlight or the eye of Mordor, the fertility eye of doom then cast its shadow onto Jenna. And I then fell into that support role, which actually is a hard place to be because I did feel cast aside by the medical professionals to a degree, by the people sort of always asking now how she was, but I was dealing with a tremendous amount of guilt because of the pain that she was in from the injections, not to mention the fact that she had a serious needle phobia and would often faint when we were at the clinic doing blood samples, for example. I've got about 8 pictures of her fainting different times. And so then suddenly we're just at home with these needles, she's got to do it herself. So, you know, what the feelings I had, and I felt so helpless and guilty, and we pressed on, and we were due to, we had the egg retrieval in mid-December and had that, the kind of the wait where overnight, so you have a certain amount of eggs, which you hope that are developed, and then you have overnight, you get the kind of score of how many have actually developed overnight into the 1 day blastocyst. But then what you're looking to do is get to the 5 day or sometimes 3 day blastocyst will be transferred. But what happened with us is that Jenna actually produced 26 eggs, which is a hell of a number, but that comes with consequences. And that was, she developed ovarian hyperstimulation syndrome because essentially, this is the clues in the title, but her ovaries became overstimulated, produced so many follicles, so many eggs, that when all those eggs were taken out of the follicles, 13 on each side, they essentially filled with fluid. And it's really serious and can be fatal. And she was really poorly. So we knew she had that almost immediately because of the way they can tell. And so we knew that we wouldn't be having that embryo transfer in 5 days or at all for an unlimited amount of time. And it was so hard because we thought we were finally getting somewhere. And so then we had the rug pulled completely again. And there's literally, they just said, right, it gave us all this information about what it is. If you feel this symptom or that symptom, don't come here. Don't phone your doctors. Go straight to hospital or call 999. And you're like, flipping hell, this is serious. And I actually had to phone the clinic back up when I got home because I was in like a state of shock. And obviously, not to mention the massive upset of knowing we wouldn't be having the transfer. I was in shock. My wife was so ill immediately, like really ill. And so I had to phone her back up to find out that kind of aftercare. And it was really hard. I remember she went to bed like almost immediately. We got home and she was breathing so shallow. Like, because her ovaries were really swollen and it pushes up and diaphragm really impacts breathing. And I remember I kept going up and checking on her. She was breathing so like shallowly, is that even a word, so shallow, and like really like just faint short breaths, and really scary. And and that was really hard in the fact that we were just told like, you just gotta go away, the your embryos will be frozen, and you have to wait till you get better.
Wait, because the same thing happened to Jen during when we were going for Enya. She overstimulated, and it is, as a partner, it is one of the scariest things I've ever experienced. Like, as a husband,
it was. Yeah,
just like they give you, like you said, the limited information, but it's like the most critical information you could have. they make it sound, well, they do make it sound exactly what it is, which is really dangerous. Yet you have to keep calm, keep collective, even though your anxieties are through the roof right at that moment, because you've just been told an additional piece of information that's put everything on hold. But somehow you muddle through, don't you? Somehow, that's the only way I can describe it, just muddling through.
Yeah, that basically sums up any fertility journey. You don't know how you do it, you just muddle on.
Like, but given that information, like as you were explaining it then, it just brought back my memories of being told, like, you're overstimulating, you can't go ahead.
Yeah. No, it's really tough.
After all these injections, after all this miniature journey within a journey.
I remember the next morning, the morning when they told her, when they phoned us to give us the overnight results, which was that 21 had made that overnight stage.
Yeah.
The embryologist that phoned us, sometimes some people in life are so brilliant without even really knowing, or I think even trying. And you could tell that her answer was so natural and unrehearsed, unscripted. And so she gave us a number and we were like, oh, she was like, that's fantastic. Well done. And Jenna said, well, you know, not that it matters right now because I've got OHSS and we have to wait an unlimited amount of time and have a frozen transfer. And she was just so flippant and so quick. And bear in mind, this is a scientist whose expertise is fertility. Mm-hmm. She went, well, there is a massive school of thought that actually frozen transfers are better because it lets your body get over all the medication that you've been taking, all the hormones, all the stimulants for the last couple of weeks or a month. That actually then you're in a more natural state. And that made us feel so much more positive. And we tried to give feedback. Like we said, can whoever, that if it's noted who phoned us, this was months down the line, but we were like, can that embryologist please be thanked, because her words meant so much to us.
Yeah.
And so, you know, that the next couple of months were actually for Jenna, especially, a really dark place, because we were just in this, kind of again in the doldrums, didn't know how long it was going to be until we could go again, and then also in the days after, her belly swelled so much it looked like she was 6 months pregnant. That was really hard, because that's what you desperately want to be, and we were so far from it at that point.
I remember, like, once it all started to flush out, she just couldn't get off the loo, like just urinating all the time. The amount of water the body was just flooding out was unbelievable. But exactly what you said, that distinct kind of big stomach, really like swollen stomach. And it's hard to see, like, almost, because it's a view you want to see, but with a baby in there.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, she was really in a bad place and really withdrew actually from a lot of social stuff, a lot of seeing friends and family, and that's what she's all about. She's such a social butterfly, but to see her do that, it was really hard. We ended up with 12 embryos out of that. It's a really good number. And actually, so kind of fast forward another couple of months and more waiting, we went in for more tests and stuff, and in February 2020, this one it was, they said, okay, you're ready. On your next cycle, your next monthly cycle, you're going to be ready to go again. We knew roughly when it would be, and had the dates, had all the meds ready to go. We were due to start in 2 days' time, and then March 20th or 22nd of March?
Lockdown. 21st, I think it was.
Whatever the date was of the big lockdown, we were 2 days after that, we were due to start again, and all the fertility clinics were shut immediately. And again, we're just in this phase of not knowing what's going on. And I know, like, you know, the whole country, the whole world was in this, like, in any respect. And actually, do you know what? By that point, we were like, this is the whole thing has been out of our control, the whole fertility struggle. But this is really out of our control. It was a worldwide thing. And actually, we just kind of embraced it. We played the game, you know, we did what we were being told to do, not that the government were, but let's not make this a political podcast.
let's not talk about that one, mate.
But we, you know, we did it, and we actually, it was good for us as a couple, because with our work, we were often, or could be, like passing ships in the night, but suddenly we were together all the time. And it was I know, for some that can drive people crazy, but because we didn't really ever have that time before, it was good.
Yeah.
We really started focusing on health, on mind and body. We were exercising all the time together, and then obviously going out for our hour walk that you could have, and having garden workouts. And then obviously you'll remember that May was just gloriously hot, like every day, the sunniest May on record or whatever it was. And we were just in the garden all the time. And we got pissed sometimes, and that's what we needed, that blowout. I mean,
yeah.
I had a really funny video where we're playing beer pong, and here's just a general tip for anyone, but don't play beer pong with me because I have an extremely good aim. I'm basically like the best cricketer that never was. I'm a very, very good thrower and a very, very good catcher.
Yeah. But
I've never been into cricket. I should. I played once for my local team, got bowled out for a golden duck, I think it is. I actually stumped myself out as well. But anyway, I could have just been a fielder my whole career. I would have been brilliant. But anyway, digress.
Money doing that, mate.
Yeah. Just if your turn to come back. No, I don't do that. I just feel. I just catch. anyway, we had a good time. And actually, it was May of that year that the clinics were given the green light to open.
Yep.
But that was very dependent on the clinic, whether they could pass certain tests with the government about how they're set up. And we were fortunate that ours was open straight away. And as it happens as well, Jenna was in the right place in her cycle, and we were able just to go. We didn't have to go there again because we had all the meds.
Yeah.
And we were just, they were like, right, go. This is your date. They sent us through like the forms with what you do on what day, what measurements. And that was the one. And we had the Umbro transfer. So it was technically our first transfer, but it took so long to bloody get there.
Yeah.
I think it was third time of asking. And it was, fortunately for us, it was positive. And that then became our amazing, beautiful twins, Ray and Evelyn, who were born in February 21.
That's what it's all about at the end of the day, yeah. Isn't it? Yeah, it was one cycle, but it took a long time to get there, didn't it?
Didn't it just?
Up and down, starting, stopping. But you got there and you got what you set out for, how did you feel when those little ones were first handed to you?
Mm. It was quite incredible, but scary in other ways. I mean, I found the whole pregnancy quite an anxious time because I was just hyper aware of we're not there yet. Even though it was a massive relief to get that positive test and then the 12-week scan, I was just a wreck. We had three or four late night trips to the maternity ward, for scans because of perceived lack of movement. I wasn't allowed in because it was COVID time, so a lot of time sat out in the car listening to TalkSport with like absolute knots in my stomach. I had, my mind was playing a lot of tricks on me during a pregnancy about connection and how would I feel, and it's like that internal safety mechanism of like,
yeah,
this is your last chance to get out of dodge. This is something we definitely need to explore more because it's quite common amongst the guys I speak to. So when we got there, when they were born, amazing. The birth wasn't great for Jenna. We did cesarean, which is planned, which is the preferred route for twins. But she lost a lot of blood and had to have 3 blood transfusions. Was extremely poorly after that. So no part of our journey was easy. She was so ill that, because it was, again, COVID times, I wasn't allowed into the theatre until she was all literally wired up, ready to go to have the babies. And quite a funny story, but my mate who had a couple of kids said, right, before you go in, make sure you have a shit, a nervous poo.
Podcast there. Going for a cesarean, have a shit.
Exactly. I popped into town because I was like, because they said, look, they usually try and prioritize twin cesareans, but there's a chance that emergency ones will be ahead of you, overnighters and stuff.
Yeah.
So I popped into town, got coffee and came back towards the hospital. Was like, oh, I need poo. It's coming. Yeah. Not just the baby, something else is coming. So I was there and I was on the toilet and then Jenna gives me the call. She's like, we're going in. I was like, oh God. So anyway, got in there and and then, you know, she had them, Ray came out first and she was holding him, and then this alarm went off and all these other, I call them the big dogs, ran in, that you could tell by their just the way they carried themselves that they were like the experienced on-call crew.
Yeah, yeah.
Then Evelyn came out and I was just, we'd had this plan that if either or both needed to go to the NICU for any reason, I was to go. And then I remember just stood in the middle of three. I've got Ray not breathing, but with one midwife who was going, come on, come on, like rubbing him, tapping him and stuff. And then we've got Evelyn with a gaggle of about six people around her.
Yeah.
And I've got Jenna going purple, or like her like lips, nose, ears were going purple. Her face was just like white.
Yeah.
And like shaking, like convulsing as well. And I'm like, right, as much as I want these kids, I did not sign up to lose Jenna for this. And I stood in the middle of the room. I didn't know what to do. And then they would have said, right, Evelyn needs to go to the NICU. And I was like, well, fuck, I've got to go. And it was like really hard leaving Ray, Jenna, and then going. But, you know, that's our agreement. I had to do it. And she wasn't in there for long, thankfully, about an hour. And then I went to the recovery ward, and then Ray got wheeled in. It's the first time I held him then. And then, so I was with the two kids on my own. Then about, I don't know, half an hour later or so, Jenna then came in, still extremely pale, very clammy, very cold. She had like millions of blankets on her, still shaking, saying she was cold. And, you know, there's always, and this will be clear throughout both of our stories, there's always a positive to be found. And so because it was COVID times, I was told that I'm only allowed in the recovery ward following the operation. And then after that, when Jenna goes to the maternity ward, I have to go. I'm not allowed in there.
Yeah.
And they were saying the average time in a recovery ward is 2 to 4 hours. But because of what happened to her and how poorly she was in there for 36.
Right.
So I was there the whole time. And it was like a baptism of fire for me with the kids. She was 2 weeks to do anything. I was feeding them the colostrum that we'd been collecting leading up to there. I was doing the nappies with a little bit of like help and guidance from the midwives. But
yeah, yeah. Which they do an amazing job, mate.
They were brilliant.
Those women that work in that ward and, you know, help.
It's funny because
lost fathers at certain points, mate.
Yeah.
It's an amazing thing.
Yeah. It's, we've been told by one of our neighbors who had a kid about a month before, they were like, right, there's no food in the hospitals. Like, take your own. They won't give you any.
Yeah.
Because it's all like very sanitized, very, you know, just wary of stuff. Honestly, I've never been so well fed. I had this like bag full of pot noodles and sweets and stuff, but no, they were scrammy right away.
That's all right, isn't it?
But it was, you know, it was so, that was a great time for me to bond with the kids and to start doing all stuff. And I remember when we got home a couple of days later, Jenna was still weak, you know, really bruised and stuff in the op. And then when she eventually was able to say, like, I want to start changing nappies and stuff, and she was like, oh, what do you do? And I was like, I'll show you. I got this.
I've got this.
Yeah. So yeah, you know, it was a good time for me to really jump in at the deep end with fatherhood, and it was special. And I know it's a cliche, but it truly was, like, it was just magical, and it just felt right from that moment onwards. And really special. And we've talked about the fact that parenthood needs at least one episode for itself, and we'll explore this in more detail. But yeah, it's a huge challenge, of course, but it is special. And even this evening, I get home from work at 5, they go to bed about 6:30, and making that hour and a half, 2 hours count is so vital. Like, just really appreciating every minute you get, because I'd obviously rather be with them every minute of the day, but
I've got
this annoyance called work.
Yeah, well, I've learned that the busier I get, the more important that valued time is.
Yeah.
Like, even if they've got me for 20 minutes before I go back out, it's 20 minutes of quality time, whether it's with the children or whether it's with, you know, Jen, or whether it's with my mum because she's come to see me. You know, whatever hat I've got on, making sure that's quality time. It is incredibly important. Sorry. I'll tell you something we're going to have to talk about, which will take a complete episode, is obviously the what COVID did to people's experiences.
Yeah.
Because for Enya, we went through, it was around COVID time, and it was a completely different experience to when Sebi was born. So it's definitely something I want to talk about, the difficulties around there, because it's something that's in recent years has been really hot discussion. Like, you would have talked to guys, I've talked to guys about their experiences. Really challenging time. But your story, mate, it is inspirational in terms of like how you've processed everything, how you've, you know, you're so willing to talk about it. And it had a good ending for you. It had a really positive ending. And, you know, I really appreciated you sharing it tonight. We could be here for hours, I reckon, talking about it.
And that does feel, it feels like a good place to bring this episode to a close. We've probably talked a lot more than what we planned, but that's the nature of it, isn't it? But
I think I'm up next, mate. Like, and I can talk. So we'll see how long that one is. But it's been amazing. Thanks for listening. If this episode has helped you, do us a quick favor and leave us a review. You don't even have to use your real name. Every single review helps another man find this show when he needs it the most. It's honestly the best way you can help the next guy. If you have a question or something you'd like us to talk about in the mailbag, drop us an email at themalefertilitypodcast@gmail.com. We read every message. And if you'd like a little bit more guidance and support from other men on the same journey as you are, you're welcome to join our free private community at nexusoffertility.com. It's totally confidential and designed just for you by guys who get it. For the latest updates, follow us on social media, at the Male Fertility Podcast. And remember, you're not alone.